Call the next case.
Jones versus Commonwealth, Adams French, Chief Appellate Counsel, Appellant Counsel, Christopher P. Chantel, Assistant Attorney General, Appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Catherine French, and I represent Mr. Young. May I please set aside 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Did you say three?
Three, yes. Where a defendant is forced to make a Hobson's choice between a right to speedy trial and other rights, because of Commonwealth fault, any delay in speedy trial must be imputed to the Commonwealth. And this is regardless of the intent of the Commonwealth, and especially as in here, where there is a situation where the defendant is objecting to attribute any time to the defense. So is the burden on the Commonwealth to excuse any delay in trying Young within the speedy trial period. Here, the Commonwealth had other remedies available to meet both its discovery obligations and speedy trial.
How do we, Ms. French, get around subsection 4 of the statute, which literally says if you don't object to the continuance, it doesn't count? It doesn't matter what the reason for the continuance is, whether you wanted it, you didn't want it, but if you don't object to the continuance.
Well, here Young did object to the continuance. And Young objected to the court-ordered continuance, if you look at Joint Appendix pages 440 to 448. And I can walk you through exactly how it is that Young's counsel objected. So the court found that the Commonwealth had failed in its discovery obligations and actually ordered supplemental discovery to be filed by August 8th. Because that August 8th date was past the August 1st date, the trial court recognized that trial was not going to be had on the 1st. It was defense counsel who then brought up speedy trial and said, we don't feel this should be a situation in which Mr. Young has to forfeit his rights to a speedy trial in light of his rights to have the information that he's entitled to.
If I may cut to the chase, though, there's no doubt that there was an objection to the time counting against the defendant. There's no doubt. There's no doubt that there was an objection on the speedy trial. But there was no objection to the continuance. And the statute then controls, and it doesn't really matter under this argument that there's a reason or a poor reason or an almost poor reason for the continuance.
Two responses to that. The first is that this objection was to the continuance and to any time being counted against Mr. Young.
The defense counsel said they weren't prepared to try the case. They can't try the case by the end of the week.
Because of the Commonwealth's failure, but that was not asking, that's not equating to asking for a continuance. And the Court of Appeals found that it was not even a like motion of saying that being unprepared for trial is asking for a continuance. Second of all,
but that's not the issue. Here, it's not asking for the continuance. It's the failure to object to the Commonwealth's asking for a continuance.
It was a court-ordered continuance, and there was an objection to the continuance.
Give me the page number again, counsel, where you're saying there was an objection.
Pages 440 through 448. And once again, we move this court table and ensure we're outside the speedy trial period. I don't want the court to take it that the defense is now agreeing in this essence that the three-week window be attributable, whose clock or whose time. This says, to count this as the defendant's continuance would be fundamentally unfair and inappropriate given the Commonwealth's fault in discovery. Those are objectionable words to both the continuance and to any time being counted. Additionally, for the second part of that answer is...
Counsel said they weren't prepared to try... She wasn't prepared to try the case. She never said, I object to continuing it under any circumstance, whether you attribute it to me or attribute it to them or attribute it to anybody. You want to do this, Judge, but I object to that. I'm ready to try the case as scheduled. That's what an objection is, but that's what we're struggling to find in these four pages.
Saying that you're not prepared to try, you're not prepared to try the case is not saying I want a continuance. Counsel was saying, I'm not prepared to try this case.
It's not saying you want a continuance. The question is whether you objected to a continuance.
The objection to the continuance was within those eight pages, and
read exactly the language of the objection.
Okay. I think that it's trying to read all of it, but I think that the part of it is that this,
which
to
say... Which
page
are you on?
447.
444?
447. And then I'll kind of, because I think the other language is also part of the objection, but 447 I'll start with first. To say that this is now the defendant's continuance would be fundamentally unfair and inappropriate given the Commonwealth's fault with discovery, i.e., this is not going to be the defendant's continuance, and we're objecting to any continuance.
To the defendant's continuance. You're objecting, and it was a good objection. Judge, you want to do this. I'm not asking for this. And I object to anybody saying it's my continuance. Okay, great. But that's not what the statute's after. If the prosecution seeks a continuance or the sua sponte judge does a continuance, you still have to object. You have to say, I object to moving the trial date from where it is today to where you want to move it. I object to you doing that. And then by the statute, it's game over.
The words equaled an objection, even though there was not the express words, I object. Everything in context, what was saying that this is not our continuance, this is the Commonwealth's fault, this is the Commonwealth's continuance, we're not prepared because they're putting us in this position. We're objecting. We're not giving up our speedy trial rights. And I would ask the court to consider Turner versus Commonwealth and Cantwell and those lines of cases, which has said without anything in a court order or elsewhere in the record to show that a defendant agreed to or concurred in the delay of his trial or instigated a proceeding which of necessity brought about a delay of his trial, the delay must be attributed to the Commonwealth.
Is there a distinction between saying I object to a continuance and I object to any delay being counted against my client?
It depends. Here, when you look at the context of this isn't just saying, I refuse to waive my speedy trial rights. In some cases, it may be that a simple statement of I'm refusing to waive my speedy trial rights isn't enough to be considered an objection to a court order continuance. But in other cases, especially where the defendant was placed in a Hobson's choice because of the fault of the Commonwealth, and you look at the context of not just I'm not waiving my speedy trial rights, but also this is not the defendant's continuance. This has to be attributed to the Commonwealth because of the fault in discovery. The Commonwealth, the continuance was for the benefit of the Commonwealth.
But so was the trial judge's offer to release the defendant on bond. I mean, the Hobson's choice falls apart. The defendant had a choice, which is release me and put me into the nine-month category. And the answer given now is, well, he was held on other charges. What difference does that make to the trial judge?
There was no offer of bond. The Commonwealth could have moved for bond, and if the Commonwealth did that, as in White, if the Commonwealth said, I'm moving to have Mr. Young released on a personal recognizance bond, and the court agreed, then we wouldn't be here. The Commonwealth could have remedied this situation,
but
protecting both.
You were at the trial lawyer, were you?
Wait, I'm sorry?
You were at the trial lawyer, were you?
No.
Okay, well, the lawyer who was the trial lawyer said, well, it wouldn't make any difference because he's being held on other charges. That was the response.
There was still not an offer, and a defendant should not be placed. Defendant does not have a duty to save the Commonwealth from itself and ask to be released on a personal recognizance bond when he'd still be incarcerated.
I'm very sympathetic to the position, and it's awful because this is an example of where the Commonwealth could, by negligence or on purpose, basically jam a defendant into a speedy trial problem, just like you have here. But we can't add to the statute. The statute says what it says. And what you're saying is to treat the observation of the trial lawyer, I object to this being charged against my client. That's not what the statute says. You have to object to the continuance. Now, what the effect of that is another matter altogether. And I just don't know how we can redraft the statute to give relief where I have to agree ought to be given.
Okay. First, I think I've already kind of explained the point that I do think that Mr. Young objected. But even looking at the language of the statute, Section 4 is when you're talking about a continuance with either party. We're talking about a court-ordered continuance, which is an implied exception to the speedy trial rule. And when you look at the case law, which has developed that implied exception in the court-ordered continuance, Cantwell and Turner, Cantwell instructs the court to look who is responsible for that court-ordered continuance. And in Cantwell, it was the defendant. Here is the Commonwealth. So I think the statutory, with subsection 4, that language still, even with the amendments, is still the defendant or the Commonwealth continuances. Court-ordered continuances are an implied exception, and in order to look at who that delay is imputed to, you look at who caused the delay, and in this case, it was the Commonwealth.
Let me ask you this question. On the bond point, trial judges have very broad discretion on granting bonds, setting terms, denying whatever. So it may well be the prosecutor would have said, and we don't have this, I'm asking that you release him on bond. And the judge says, wait a minute, look at these charges, possible maximum of life, he could flee. I'm not going to do that. So we don't even know what the trial judge would have done if that had happened.
Correct.
Right?
And I actually think that the trial court agreed with counsel and found that bond would be a hollow remedy in addition.
Right. But I mean, the point is,
We're speculating.
It would be a lot less speculation if you had, the charges of trespass or a crack pipe or whatever it is. It's pretty serious charges with a very serious time, mm-hmm. potentially. And so it's harder for me to say, oh, well, the court definitely would have or would not have done one thing or another.
Correct. Yes.
Cantwell. But the reason we don't know is because the defense attorney said, let's don't go down that route because it doesn't do me any good at all. He's going to be held on other charges.
Defendant doesn't have a duty to ask for bond to relieve the Commonwealth of its speedy trial obligations and to have that. The defendant can choose between whether it's 5 months or whether it's. If there wasn't a personal recognizance bond, this is a situation unlike White. Doesn't have a duty to move for a bond, and bond was never offered here. I'm sorry, was there Justice Powell?
I was going to ask about the implied court-ordered continuance and your position as you then look to who caused the delay.
Yes.
Does looking to who caused the delay then point us to Taylor to look as to whether the cause of the delay was in bad faith?
No, Taylor only applies to when is the defendant moving for a continuance, and that makes sense. I know I'm kind of getting my rebuttal period, so I'll try to answer this quickly, is that when Taylor, the defendant moved for a continuance, and okay, if a defendant moves for a continuance, that time should be counted against the defendant. And it should only be in that very rare exception when a defendant actually expressly moves for a continuance that it should not be counted against the defendant because they made that motion. And that rare exception is when the Commonwealth acts in bad faith. That bad faith exception does not apply when there's a court-ordered continuance. And if I could reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Chris Chandeville on behalf of the Commonwealth. In this appeal, Young claims that he objected to a court-initiated continuance, and as a result of that alleged objection, the speedy trial clock was tolled. That argument is foreclosed, number one, by the record, number one, by the plain language of the speedy trial statute, number three, by this Court's 2011 decision in Howard versus Commonwealth, and number four, by the General Assembly's legislative acquiescence in the Court of Appeals' 1987 decision in Taylor. If we start with the record pages cited by opposing counsel at pages 4, I believe it's 440 through 448. Defense counsel at the trial level never objected to the court continuing the trial date, never objected to that delay. In fact, multiple
isn't
times...
Isn't that a pretty subtle distinction? I mean, the counsel made... I mean, in other words, he's not saying, oh, that's fine, thank you for the continuance, now I can go to trial prepared. I mean, this was... counsel making clear that I'm not agreeing to any speedy trial, you know, docking of my client's rights. Do we need to draw the distinction that subtly?
With respect, Your Honor, it is not a subtle distinction. It is a very important distinction, because there's a very big difference between saying, Your Honor, we object to any delay in this trial. A defendant asserting his right to a speedy trial would say we object to a delay because that defendant wants to be tried quickly. There's a big difference in that and then saying what this defense counsel said, which is we actually need a delay in trial. We just don't want to be held accountable for that delay. We just don't want to not be able to assert our speedy trial rights later. So what she's effectively saying is we're not asserting our speedy trial rights now, but we still want to be able to come back and assert our speedy trial rights later and get a dismissal.
In other words, we don't want a speedy trial. What we want is a discharge for not having a speedy trial.
Correct, Your Honor. And that is why the plain language of the statute is written in such a way that what she has to do is she has to object to the motion for continuance. Not that she has to object to being that continuance being attributed to her. She has to object to the actual delay.
What choice did they have under the facts of this case where the Commonwealth is sort of rolling out exculpatory evidence on a slow walk pace, and they can't be ready for trial, and they have the speedy trial deadline?
I think there are a few options available to the trial court and to the Commonwealth and to defense counsel. One option is for the trial court to resolve what the trial court eventually found were discovery violations. The court said there was no bad faith, there's no intentional effort on the Commonwealth to delay trial, but there was implicitly negligence that resulted in the need for delay, according to defense counsel. So the trial court said, in order to resolve those violations, we are going to require the Commonwealth to stipulate. So one of the alleged violations was not turning over certificate of analysis in time, showing that there had been some fingerprints testing done. So the Commonwealth said, we would be willing to stipulate that his fingerprints were not on that phone.
They did make some concessions. The trial court did impose some punishment, if you will. But even at the last hearing, there was still discovery that the court had ordered that had not been provided.
There was still some disagreement about what the court's order actually meant in terms of the substance of some of these interviews. But in terms of the primary piece of evidence that defense counsel claimed she did not get in time to prepare for trial, that was the testing for fingerprints on the phone, and that was the recorded phone calls from the jail. And the trial court dealt with both of those and said, you have to stipulate that his fingerprints were not on the phone, and you're not allowed, Commonwealth, you're not allowed to use those phone calls. In other words, the trial court went out of its way to limit the evidence the Commonwealth was permitted to use at trial so that trial still could go forward on the date scheduled. The other option, and gave that option to the defense counsel. The defense counsel said, no, I still don't think I'll be ready for trial, even with those concessions. The other option, of course, the Commonwealth could have pursued if defense counsel had objected to the delay. By not objecting to the delay, the Commonwealth was not on notice that it had a potential speedy trial problem, because under the plain language of the speedy trial statute, the failure to object meant that that time is excused under the exception in the statute. If there had been an objection to the delay, Commonwealth could have malprossed the charges at that time. Then the speedy trial clock stops, and it starts over again with an indictment. And this court held in Harris that in the absence of bad faith, that does stop the speedy trial clock and restarts it. So that was another option that is available.
And the defendant regains liberty in the interim.
And the defendant regains liberty in the interim. The third option, of course, was the option of bond. And we have argued in the Court of Appeals, and we continue to argue in this court, and that we do have an approbate and reprobate problem here. And it's not an argument.
The Court of Appeals said you guys conceded there was not an approbate and reprobate.
The Court of Appeals said that it appeared that we made that concession. I will stand before the court and tell the court we did not make that concession at oral argument. The Court of Appeals' opinion did not cite anywhere in the oral argument audio where we made that concession. I listened to my own voice on that audio. That concession was not made. So then the question becomes, does the appellee have to assign cross error to an error made by the Court of Appeals in order to make the same argument again in this court? And this court has said repeatedly since Perry that the appellee does not need to assign cross error in order to make an argument for an affirmance on an alternative basis unless the appellee is seeking to enlarge the rights that were granted previously or to lessen the other side's rights. And that's not at all what we're doing. We're asking the court to affirm.
Doesn't this point go more towards undermining the Hobson's choice emotion, which is I'm sitting in the corner, I've got absolutely no options, and I'm asked to pick between two bad options, and the answer is no, there was a great option staring in the face, and you said no.
Correct, Your Honor. It also goes to that argument as well as to the merits. So even if the court does not reach the approbate and reprobate argument, it undermines the argument that they had a Hobson's choice. The other option available, and the third option available to defense counsel in a case like this, where counsel is put in a position of having to question whether or not she's going to be prepared for trial based on some late disclosures by the Commonwealth. The other option is to make a constitutional speedy trial argument, because under the Constitution and under the factors enunciated by the United States Supreme Court in Barker versus Wingo, and under this court's decision in Folks versus Commonwealth, it is absolutely relevant to the constitutional speedy trial analysis whether the Commonwealth's negligence resulted in delays, because you look at the reasons for the delay. And in Folks, this court reversed based on that negligence.
Make that argument prior to the expiration of the speedy trial requirements?
I apologize, Your Honor. I talked over the first part of your question.
You're saying that the defendant had a reasonable option to make a speedy trial argument prior to the expiration of the time allotted under the Speedy Trial Act, and that was a reasonable option?
No, what I'm arguing is so that the reasonable options prior to the expiration of that statutory speedy trial clock running. The reasonable options were a null pros or to get bond or to limit the discovery.
The problem with your options is they're all options for people other than the defendant. The trial judge could have done this. The prosecutor could have done this. These were all wonderful options. But what are the defendant's options? The defendant is the one that's being deprived of the benefit of the speedy trial.
The defendant's option was not to do what defense counsel did here, which was to dissuade the trial court from granting a bond. I'm not asserting, the Commonwealth is not asserting, the defense has an affirmative duty to move for bond, but that's not what happened here. What happened here is when bond was suggested, defense counsel told the trial court that would be a hollow remedy and that would not be an appropriate remedy. That's at page 445.
Well, I agree with you there. That was a mistake.
And by making that assertion before the speedy trial clock ran, by asserting that would not be an appropriate remedy, she cannot then come back after the speedy trial clock had run and then argue to the court, well, that would have been a remedy that would have preserved my client's statutory speedy trial rights, but because the trial court didn't go down that route, now we have a speedy trial problem. That is the inconsistent position taken by defense counsel that should lead this court to conclude that defense counsel is approbating and reprobating. But the point that I was making earlier about the distinction between the statutory speedy trial right and the constitutional speedy trial right, the option available to defense counsel, even after the clock had run and even after at the point came where she filed her motion to dismiss for alleged speedy trial failures, she made a statutory speedy trial argument. She also could have made a constitutional speedy trial argument. Under the constitutional speedy trial analysis, negligence on the part of the Commonwealth leading to a delay is relevant to that consideration. So she had an argument that could have been made as to why her client's constitutional speedy trial rights were violated. She chose not to make that argument, has not made that argument on appeal. So a defendant like Mr. Young is not left without any options in a circumstance like this. He's just not left with options in the statutory speedy trial context when he fails to make an objection. So for that reason, the trial court was absolutely correct to overrule that motion to dismiss based on statutory speedy trial grounds. My third point, which is this court's decision in 2011 in Howard. In 2011 in Howard, this court held that a court-initiated continuance is of a similar nature to a continuous motion on behalf of the Commonwealth. And as a result of that, the same rules apply to court-initiated continuances that apply to continuances on behalf of the Commonwealth, made by the Commonwealth. So when counsel for Mr. Young tries to argue here that certain cases are distinguishable because here we have a court-initiated continuance, whereas in those cases we had a defense continuance or a Commonwealth continuance, after 2011, that distinction is irrelevant. The same rules apply under the statute. So the plain language applies under the statute. So she had a duty to object. She's not asked this court to overrule Howard, and this court should not overrule Howard.
If the defense counsel had said, look, I object to the continuance. My client wants to go to trial on trial day. It's a speedy date, and that's what I want. But I also want you to exclude all this evidence the Commonwealth wants to bring in to court as a sanction for their discovery violations. Couldn't that have remedied all of it if the trial judge had done that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it could have. One, it would have prevented the speedy trial clock from being told.
Where's the Hobson's choice? I mean, if I'm a defense counsel, I would prefer that. I kick out a third of the incriminating evidence or the alleged incriminating evidence. I'm ready for trial otherwise. I should be ready for trial otherwise, because the only reason for not being ready for trial in this case was the alleged discovery violations. Well, in a civil case, the right answer would be, I'm ready to go to trial. Kick out half of their case, and I'll go to trial tomorrow.
That's correct, Your Honor. There were those options available to this defendant, and the Commonwealth and the trial court had made it clear that they were willing to exclude certain evidence, to make certain stipulations, so the defense counsel and the defendant could go to trial on the date set for trial. But defense counsel repeatedly said she wouldn't be ready.
This hearing, what was the status of the Commonwealth's compliance with Brady?
At this hearing, the Commonwealth had already turned over this certificate of analysis that said that the phone had been tested for fingerprints, but it had been the results were inconclusive as to Mr. Young's fingerprints. But it couldn't rule out these other two individuals involved, and it possibly could have had their fingerprints on it. The Commonwealth responded, acknowledged that it wasn't a Brady violation because trial hadn't occurred yet. We weren't at trial, so there were no Brady violations. It was a late disclosure under the discovery order that had been entered. The Commonwealth said was, I'm willing to stipulate his fingerprints were not on the phone, which goes further than the certificate of analysis said. The certificate of analysis just said it was inconclusive. And the trial court said, I will hold you to that stipulation that his fingerprints weren't there so that we can keep our original trial date, so that we can do this within speedy trial. And defense counsel said, I'm still not willing. I'm still not going to be prepared. On top of that, there was also a late disclosure of some audio of some phone calls that Mr. Young made from the jail. So arguably that was covered by the discovery order, should have been disclosed earlier. The Commonwealth said, I don't intend to use them, and so I made a mistake by not turning them over earlier. Still turned over 2.5 to 3 weeks before trial, but the trial court said, because he disclosed those late, I prohibit you from using those phone calls for any reason at trial. Again, going out of its way to try to keep that originally scheduled date, and defense counsel still said I won't be prepared for trial.
So those are the two main things, the two main discovery things, the fingerprints on the phone and the phone records?
Yes, Your Honor. And then there's some dispute over the extent to which certain interviews between the police and certain witnesses, the victim, the co-defendant, the recorded statements had all been turned over. There was dispute over whether or not there was portions of those interviews that weren't recorded, the substance of which also needed to be turned over, and there was dispute over whether or not the Commonwealth had turned over enough.
Wasn't
but those were the primary
late,
pieces.
A late production of an inconsistent proffer from the co-defendant?
There was a more recent proffer session that occurred, I think, the day before. July 13th, and then it was turned over on July 14th. So it was turned over the very next day. And the argument was that disclosure was late because it should have been turned over much earlier under the court's order. But it was turned over the day after the proffer occurred. So that should not be held to be a discovery violation, given that the proffer session itself occurred much later in
short
the process.
Short of mastering time travel technology.
Correct, Your Honor. There was no discovery violation as to that, and turned it over, like I said, the next day. Now, she argued, well, I want more time to go back and read through that statement and to prepare for trial so I can try to impeach the co-defendant based on statements made there. But again, that's not a defendant who's asserting speedy trial rights. That's a defendant who wants more time to prepare, but was not presented with a Hobson's choice, perhaps a difficult choice. The Constitution prohibits forcing defendants from choosing between one constitutional right on the other hand, but another constitutional right on the other hand. That is not what occurred here. He hasn't even asserted through counsel a violation of constitutional speedy trial rights. We had a difficult choice the defendants are required to make all the time. There were attempts to remedy the problem. Counsel decided not to avail herself of that. If there are no further questions, I will rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
All right, Ms. French, you have 1:47 left.
Cantwell, even though that's a case that came before the amendments that opposing counsel talked about, there's been cases since the amendments, such as Turner in 2017, that cite to Cantwell. And in Cantwell, you look at for court-ordered continuances. You look at who was the party that necessitated the delay. And whoever that party that necessitated the delay, Cantwell is saying that person cannot take advantage of that delay.
Ms. French, if the defense counsel had said, look, I want to go to trial, But I want you to kick out, I want the stipulation, which goes beyond the certificate on the fingerprints, and I want every single one of these phone records out of the case. Why wouldn't that have been enough to cure the problem? And isn't that a reason why the trial judge needed to hear an objection to the continuous to decide what to do?
The defendant doesn't need to show any prejudice when it comes to a speedy trial violation. The burden is on the Commonwealth. The continuance was for the benefit of the Commonwealth to provide supplemental discovery.
Objecting to the continuance and objecting to the time being allocated to you. I mean, that's the whole debate you have with us, right? So your argument is they're basically the same thing. And what I'm trying to ask you is they're not basically the same thing. But if the defense counsel flat out said, I object to continue. I want to go to trial on the trial date right now. I'm ready. So long as you kick out all this discovery stuff. Well, isn't that, where's the Hobson choice in that? That sounds like a very good trial tactic.
First of all, the Court of Appeals found there was a Hobson's choice, and the Commonwealth never assigned cross error to that finding. Even if this court did find, even assuming that, can I answer
absolutely
the question? Even putting aside whether or not Young objected to the continuance, because we're saying Young did object to the continuance, and you're saying, no, he didn't, he only objected to the waiver. There's a whole, that doesn't, this court can resolve this case not on that issue, but on whether or not the court-ordered continuance, it was caused by the Commonwealth's failures, and therefore that time is imputed to the Commonwealth, based under Turner and Cantwell, and the Commonwealth can't take advantage of that delay.
All right, thank you very much. Call the next case.